Hi, I'm Jim Epstein with The Reason Podcast. Please, if you haven't already, subscribe to our podcast. And if you like what you hear, go over to iTunes and drop us a rating and leave a review saying what we're doing well and what we could be doing better. Today's topic is the impact that Bitcoin is having in Latin America, and specifically in Venezuela. I have a piece in the current issue of Reason Magazine called The Secret Dangerous World of Venezuelan Bitcoin Mining. And it looks at how Bitcoin is allowing Venezuelans to circumvent the government and do things that would otherwise be pretty difficult, such as import food and medicine from abroad. So to discuss, my guest today is Rodrigo Souza, who's featured in the piece. Now, he's a Brazilian-born entrepreneur who founded a company called Blinktrade, which is headquartered in Brooklyn and operates major Bitcoin exchanges, not only in Venezuela, but also in Brazil, Vietnam, Pakistan, and Chile. We talked about why Bitcoin is having such a major impact in Venezuela, how it's being used in Brazil, which is Souza's native country, and also his personal experience with inflation growing up there. And finally, we discussed how and why he became a libertarian. So here's my conversation with Rodrigo Souza. Rodrigo, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I actually mainly want to talk today about the Bitcoin phenomenon in Venezuela and your work in that country specifically. Tell me about Sir Bitcoin. Now, you're the founder and CEO of Blinktrade. Tell me about what Sir Bitcoin is in relationship to Blinktrade and what Sir Bitcoin is in Venezuela.
All right. Sir Bitcoin is kind of a brokerage firm. It would be like for people who invest in stocks here in US, Blinktrade would be like the New York Stock Exchange, and Sir Bitcoin would be like E-Trade or any other brokerage that you have access to the liquidity. So Blinktrade is a liquidity pool for brokers all around the world, but we are operating only in 5 countries so far, and Venezuela is one of the countries we are operating. And Sir Bitcoin is the one that the customers, they, in order for them to access, they must get access to Sir Bitcoin. They must create an account in Sir Bitcoin, and that's where they can transact and can buy and sell.
Buy and sell what? What do you do? If I'm in Venezuela, I start a Sir Bitcoin account, what can I do?
You can transfer bolivars from your personal bank account to our personal bank account, to Sir Bitcoin bank account. And then we credit it. We give you, it's like, okay, you have that amount of bolivars with us. Then you can actually place an offer to buy Bitcoin from another user who needs to sell the Bitcoins for any other reason, yes.
So you can buy, you trade, it's a platform for trading Bitcoins and bolivars.
Yes.
What is the trade volume like? Give me kind of a snapshot.
Oh, it's growing every day. Last week, he broke the record. I mean, every week we are growing 20%. So we are growing week by week 20% in number of users, in volume. Like last week alone, he did $200,000 in transactions, which you might think, oh, it's not much. But when you are in a country where the average salary is like $25, it's a lot of money. And if you look in bolivars, it's a lot of bolivars being transacted. So I would say number of users we have around, we are closing to 100,000 users, almost there.
And compare it, you are also, you're the CEO of Blinktrade, which is also operating Foxbit, which is the biggest Bitcoin exchange in Brazil. Now, Brazil is sort of the number one country for Bitcoin in Latin America. Compare Sir Bitcoin to Foxbit and Sir Bitcoin, the biggest country to Venezuela.
Today, the Brazilians have much more wealth than Venezuela. So the average ticket in Brazil is like 10 times the Venezuelan. So while in Venezuela, they are buying average $40, Brazil, they are buying average $500, right? But in number of transactions, right, in number of people buying and selling the activity, Venezuela is at least 2 times larger than Brazil. So we have much more activity, people buying and selling, small quantity in Venezuela than in Brazil. And the number of users, like 5 times. Like Venezuela has 5 times more users than we have in Brazil. So that's that's kind of like you can see the difference. But as I said, in Brazil, there are also problems. And Bitcoin in Brazil serves a completely different use case than in Venezuela.
Why are people in Venezuela turning to Bitcoin? What is the advantage?
Essentially, the Venezuelan money can't buy you almost nothing today. It's like, that's how it is. That's why people are like, they prefer dollars, right? It's like everybody knows dollars, but with Bitcoin, they can do things that they cannot do with dollars, because the only kind of dollars they have in Venezuela is cash. But you cannot spend your US dollars in cash in Amazon, for example. But you can spend your Bitcoin in Amazon by using a third-party service.
Why can't you spend your... Venezuela has a banking system. You can deposit your Venezuelan currency in a bank. What is the difference? Why can't you spend that money abroad or in other places?
Because government in 2003, government actually imposed capital control. They fixed the exchange rate. And since then, it's like restricting access to dollars. So if you have money into a Venezuelan bank, you can't go to your bank and ask, oh, can I please wire that amount of dollars to that bank account? And like, it's just impossible. You can't do that. So that, because of that, there is always like the free market, where people call black market, where people can transact dollars outside of the system. And that generates a huge imbalance. Like, the official exchange rate is like 10 bolivars per dollar. Actually, they have like three exchange rates, from 10 bolivars to dollar for like important goods that what government thinks is important. They give 10 bolivars per dollar. Then there's another one for 200. And then there's another one for 650 bolivars per dollar. Those are the three official exchange rates. But on the streets, it's just growing. Like, in the streets, it's like 1,800. But last time I checked, it was like today's morning was 2,200 bolivars per dollar on the streets.
So you're drawing, this is the official government exchange rate is a fraction of what the real value is of a bolivar abroad, because nobody really wants to buy. Bolivars are not a good currency. Nobody wants to buy bolivars. So in effect, what you're saying is, if you're in Venezuela, you can't spend your money abroad because nobody wants your money. Is that right?
Yeah, nobody. I mean, not even Venezuelans wants their money.
So the Bitcoin is not subject to these same capital controls. The government can't control Bitcoin in the same way that it can bolivars. Is that right? And why is that? What's the difference?
Well, in the law, Bitcoin is not considered a currency in Venezuela. Is more considered as a like as a digital intangible asset, so it just don't fit in the laws about currencies. So essentially, anyone can actually buy and sell the Bitcoins there. And the Bitcoins, the way the system works is there's no intermediary between any people. So essentially, I can have my Bitcoin and I can send to you like I'm sending an email, but with off no one in the middle. So not even NSA can actually block the transaction. I can send my Bitcoin to you. Nobody would know I'm sending Bitcoin to you. And it's essentially, it's a very powerful tool for that allows people to transact without anyone telling them what they can do or what they cannot do.
There's a huge Venezuelan community, specifically in Miami, although all over the U.S.
Yeah.
And they have relatives, families that are trapped in this country where the supermarkets are empty. They can't get medicine, et cetera, and they want to send money. I spoke to one woman who's using your platform, uses Sir Bitcoin, and she's actually in Brazil, and she was actually using... a family member was walking bags of cash across the border to get money in, and it was sort of dangerous and difficult. And now she's using Sir Bitcoin. And so what is she doing exactly? How does she get money to her family through Sir Bitcoin? Sort of explain that to me.
So she buys Bitcoins in Foxbit, transfer to her wallet in Sir Bitcoin, and sell to someone buying Bitcoins. Then we send money to the bank account she wants. In any bank account in Venezuela, you can send money if you have a Bitcoin. So if you are in US, you can use like Circle and other companies to buy the Bitcoins and transfer right away to SirBitcoin, that where you can trade the Bitcoins for Bolivars and send to your bank account. That's
so in other words, it's some clicks on a computer screen as opposed to accomplish all the transactions.
Yeah, it's like very fast. I mean, like less than 10 minutes you have your money in Venezuela.
But can she go to Western Union or MoneyGram?
If you go to Western Union, they're gonna give you the official exchange rate, which is 650 bolivars per dollar, and the person collecting the cash in Venezuela is like, Western Union is not gonna send money to your bank account. They're gonna give you, they're gonna give the person in Venezuela kind of like a number where you go and you get a pack of cash, because the highest denomination bill is 100 bolivars per dollar. So it's not practical, and like you don't wanna go. And I mean, I would say Venezuelans, the Venezuelan government is also using the situation to make sure all the transactions, they ban cash, because I mean, it's just impractical to use cash. It's like you're going and people are waiting the cash, not counting anymore, because the highest denomination bill is 100 bolivars, which is like 6 cents of a dollar. So it's like, cash is kind of like impractical. It's not safe for you to walk around in with cash.
Well, okay. Well, how about this other issue is as an inflation, right? So if you have money in bolivars in Venezuela, you're seeing your inflation is draining the value from that currency every day. I mean, now a bolivar is worth maybe 1/20th of a penny in the U.S. now. I mean, it's falling seemingly every day.
Yeah, it's terrible.
So are people using SirBitcoin to get out of bolivars and into Bitcoin as a store of value?
Yes, a lot. I mean, I would say 50% of our customers or buyers are small people who are buying like $20, $50. It's like, usually it's like all the money they have left. And it's sad to see that, but they buy $50, $40 worth of bolivar and in bitcoins, and they store it in bitcoins, because for them to convert $40 into a bank account, come on, no bank would ever even consider opening a bank account for you if you only have $40. So for them it's like, okay, so I saved my money. Most of those people who actually got into Bitcoin, saved it, and they made money. So we launched the exchange in 2014, right? Since 2014 to 2016, like in the 2 years we are running the exchange, the Bitcoin went up in price like by 3 times. So everybody that actually starts saving into Bitcoin in Venezuela, everybody made money. There's no single
people. Okay, but Bitcoin has still been somewhat, I mean, it was up above 1,000. It's down around 700 range now. It's not considerably thought of as, it's not traditionally thought of as the best inflation hedge. However, you know, in Venezuela and other Latin American countries, the traditional hedge against inflation has been the U.S. dollar. That is, and that's sort of the gold. The dollar has been much more stable than Bitcoin, in fact. Why aren't Venezuelans doing what they used to do, keeping their money in dollars?
I mean, rich people, they do dollars, right? If you're talking about rich people, upper middle class, they have their ways. They can protect. They don't care for the inflation. They're actually making money. But when you're talking about the poor people, where the less favorable people who have no access to a U.S. dollar bank account, or people who live in a neighborhood that's like very, very unsafe, and storing your dollars in cash in your home is like kind of asking to be killed for someone robbing your dollars. So when you're talking about those people, Bitcoin is kind of like a no-brainer for them. At least if they have anyone in their family who is capable enough to understand how to safely secure and store their Bitcoin, which there are. The knowledge is just spreading, and there will be, it just makes more sense. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Imagine if you only have $20, $30. Would it make sense to open a bank account where the bank is going to charge you a $15 monthly maintenance fee? Actually, banks in the U.S., they require you to have at least $100 to open a bank account. So it's not practical for those people. That's the essentially the reason, I would say. It just make much more sense.
Let's turn to Brazil. Bitcoin in Brazil. Sort of explain to me what is the use of Bitcoin? And I want to put aside the speculators. I know there's a financial industry in Bitcoin. There are people that are buying it and trading it every day and trying to squeeze out, you know, value here and there. But what is the use of Bitcoin in Brazil?
All right. So in Brazil, the currency is stable. Like, well, if you consider like 1% a month, inflation is stable. Yeah, Brazil is stable, right? It's not like crazy like Venezuela, but there's inflation, but not enough to justify people to say, oh, let me store my money in Brazil. No, in Brazil, we have, there's a lot of protectionism in Brazil. So that means if you try to import anything in Brazil, right, that Brazil doesn't produce, you are taxed with like 50% on customs. So what Brazilians they do is they ask their exporters, say, look, I'm going to import your MacBook, for example. I'm importing your MacBook. The price is $2,000. Can you please send me an invoice of $1,000 so I can present it to the government and I will only pay taxes on the half of the price. The other part, I will pay you through an alternative route. That alternative route is usually dangerous and money just disappear. It's like the black market where people, I mean, at the end of the day, people just don't want to pay the 50% custom taxes. And this is true in every single country that has capital, not capital controls, but has a strong protectionism. People find their ways to not pay, you know, like 50% taxes, like in Brazil.
But in effect, it's the same thing as Venezuela. It's the government is preventing the free movement of money between countries.
Well, government is...
Or goods, in the case of Brazil.
Yeah, in case of Brazil, it's goods, and government's not preventing. He's just wanting his fair share, which is not really fair.
Is it fair share? There is sort of an economic reasoning behind this, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day,
what is it? Why keep Apple products? What is the theory behind keeping Apple products out of Brazil?
I mean, Brazilian government, they believe if they tax Apple, Apple will build a factory and build apples in Brazil, and that will generate jobs in Brazil. That's the reasoning, and it's like also to protect the companies that actually did that. So let's say you Dell actually opened a factory in Brazil, in the south of Brazil, to pay less taxes, right? To get access to a lot of consumers. And government will protect those companies. And they want to protect by taxing the competitors. I think Trump wants to do the same, right? I'm not so sure, but...
And this is, I mean, a car in Brazil is very expensive, right?
It's ridiculous expensive. It's like people, when I arrived here in US, I was telling people how much I used to pay for stuff. And I was like amazed at how cheap it was. And they asked me, oh, Brazil must be a very rich country. You're paying like $2,000 on an iPhone. And I say, well, Brazilians are not rich. it's not because goods are expensive. You just don't have the goods that are expensive. It's like everything is expensive in Brazil. An iPhone here is $700. There will be at least $1,500. It was like everything is twice the price.
Okay, so let's get back to Bitcoin. Bitcoin as a way around this, and you started to kind of lay out an example. I want to buy an iPhone or say a MacBook. I want to buy a MacBook from the US. So I am going to, first of all, I'll pay for some of it the traditional way and pay the 50%.
Because you need to get clear on the customs.
So yes. I need to actually get the MacBook through the border.
Through the border.
That cannot happen on the internet. So that's the physical world. So we need to show the customs official something. So I'm going to pay, say this MacBook is $4,000.
$2,000, the invoice, you're going to ask for $2,000, the half.
Half is paid for as an $2,000, and
officially,
right. And I'm gonna pay that money, and I'll pay a 50%.
And then you're gonna pay another $1,000 to the government.
Okay.
For the $2,000, you pay for the
$1,000 goes to the government.
$1,000 goes
then,
to the government.
Then what happens?
And then the other $2,000, you buy Bitcoin, and you
through
send
Foxbit
through Foxbit to you know, to any other way. Or you might use a Hawala network, which is like has like really illegal money in it and brokers that don't really care where the money came
from. So Bitcoin is a better, simpler...
Well, it's much better for government. Yeah.
Why is it better for government?
Because then we have like all the clean money, like I'm talking about a market of 140 billion Brazilian reals. That's kind of like if you divide it by three, it's like close to $40 billion market where Brazilian companies they import. I'm talking about for the government, it's like, hey, you know, the money is not. We are not moving illegal money anymore. Like, there's no corruption money in our brokers. There's no money from crimes. There's no money from drugs. We make sure because otherwise we lose our bank accounts. So we are taking away the liquidity from the black market from the criminals and bringing it to where it should be. It should be.
So is it fair? Is it a? It's a safer form of tax evasion in a sense, or.
It's not a tax. I wouldn't call tax evasion because that would that has a bad connotation, right? It's a way to protect yourself against unfair tax because a 50% tax is not fair.
There's no reason why the government should take a bite when I'm buying money from someone who wants to sell me something in another country.
That's how I believe it. That's not how the average Joe on the street believes it.
Given that, why doesn't the government, though, and this is true in Venezuela, too, the Brazilian government could go to Foxbit or in Blinktrade to your company and say, stop this. This is you're getting around. You got to pay us our 50%. This is our revenue.
Well, if they do that, we shoot our door. We shoot down. But that doesn't stop Bitcoin. Actually, it's going to make it much worse. I don't think government wants to do that because at the end of the day, they're not stupid. They're only looking after revenue. They can come to us and ask for a piece of the revenue or in form of taxations. But if at the end of the day, we're gonna pass our costs on the consumer and the consumer is not going to trade with us. They're going to go to alternative ways to buy and sell Bitcoins, which is like peer-to-peer, and which is completely like, it's just impossible to stop.
Well, and how about in Venezuela? I mean, first of all, in Venezuela, you have these miners who are arbitraging the cost of electricity, you know, arbitraging the free electricity and putting money in their own pockets. And then they're using that this technology to route around the government's policies in terms of currency control. Why doesn't the government could shut down your exchange in Venezuela, right?
They can, but they cannot shut down Bitcoin. So it means my user who is buying Bitcoin from another user of mine, they can go directly and transact without me. The only reason they use me, the only reason Sir Bitcoin exists is not because we don't sell or buy Bitcoins from users, not even in Foxbit. Actually, I forbid the brokers to actually engage in trading against the customers. They are not allowed because they have privileged information, right? But that doesn't stop one user A buy Bitcoin from a user B and transact directly from their bank accounts. So the only reason we exist is to provide a safe way to do the transaction. But who is transacting is our user is transacting against our other user. We are just providing a safe way to do it. If the government say, well, you have to tax this, and it would make not viable for them. They would just use.
It's probably. I mean, Bitcoin is at its core. It's a peer-to-peer technology. Yeah. You're actually a central exchange, but you're not necessary.
No.
And there, what is another phenomenon in Venezuela? And possibly Brazil too, I'm not sure. I know it's in countries all over the world, is a site called Local Bitcoins, right? What is that?
Well, Local Bitcoins, it's essentially, it's an exchange, but they use escrow mechanisms. Like they escrow the Bitcoins and they only release the Bitcoins after both parties confirm that the fiat was exchanged. In my exchange, it's like we escrow the fiat and we escrow the Bitcoin. So we can make sure the transaction happens. In the Local Bitcoins, they are only making the Bitcoin, they are like securing the Bitcoin until the fiat transaction happen outside of local Bitcoin's control. So,
well, and they don't need a Venezuelan bank account.
No, they don't.
And that's the key thing. I mean, the Venezuelan government could interfere with you rely on having this bank account, which yeah. makes it convenient for your customers to take money, to take their bolivars out of their account and buy Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a sort of a government.
Yeah. If the government can seize my bank account anytime, but they must have a legal background to do it, and they don't, because we operate under the law.
Yeah.
So we are not there to break the law. So they just, if they want to shut down Sir Bitcoin, okay, cool. Go pass a law making it illegal to facilitate Bitcoin transactions, and you can ban me. But you cannot go to Finland and ban local Bitcoins. Tell local Bitcoins, hey, please do not operate in Venezuela, where they're going to just laugh at you.
Okay, I want to turn to your story, which is pretty interesting. You came to the U.S. in 2008 from Brazil. First of all, talk about your background in Brazil in your personal experience with inflation growing up in Brazil, and why it's sort of driven your passion for these issues.
Well, Brazil had a hyperinflation in the 90s. And I was like, I remember I was 14 when the new economic plan actually eliminated inflation. But until then, I remember very well when you were like 13, you know, the only thing you know is like, mom, give me money, I go to arcades and play video games, right? And I remember the arcade, you have to buy a token, right? And every single week, the store owner, the arcade owner, he would raise the price of the tokens because of the inflation. So when I saw that, I said, okay, cool, I'm never going to store money anymore. I was buying the tokens because I knew on next Monday I could go there and my tokens would worth more. So that's how...
So like, you were using arcade tokens as a hedge against inflation.
As a kid, yes. That was like the only thing I could do it. True, I had hedge against inflation.
Your mother also bought a house. She owned a house, right, which was sort of her life savings, and sold it it must have been about 1989, and put it in a bank account, right?
Yes.
Then what happened?
Well, she, on 1989, the President Collor was elected, and...
Fernando Collor de Mello. Yeah.
And on his first day in office... I mean, that time when, I mean, the government was paying a huge premium on the savings account. So my mama thought, okay, I'm collecting rent, because the only way Brazilians would store their wealth would be real estate. Real estate is like, okay, I don't trust the government money. I'm going to buy real estate so I can protect myself against inflation, save for the future. So my mom, my whole family did that. And my mama said, well, I'm not collecting much on the rent because of the economics. But the government is paying a really huge premium on the savings account. So savings account is safe. So she put the money in savings account. And it was collecting the interest, which was like much more than she would get on the rent. And the government was promising the savings account would just be indexed by the inflation. So when the government, on the first day in office, he declared a bank holiday.
This is President Collor.
Yes. And when he, my mom voted on him. And the first day, he took 3 days bank holidays. And after that, he freeze all the money. Everybody money was freezed. And the idea, the economic idea was like, oh, if there's too much money in the economy, we're going to freeze all the money. We're going to stop all the madness. And the inflation is going to stop. And actually, this happens. The inflation was like 50% a month. It went out to 1% in the first month, 6% in the second month. And the idea about the freeze, the assets would be freezed for 6 months initially. And then it was like for 18 months. But the thing
So 18, and this was called, it was part of a package of economic reform. Yeah. Plano Collor was the name of it. So your mom's bank account was frozen for 18 months. The idea was, the way to stop the hyperinflation is to take away people's rights, which never quite, never, always backfires.
Well, the idea was we're going to stop printing money and the inflation is going to stop, but they didn't. They made everybody do their part, which is like, okay, your money is going to be frozen for 6 months, but the government didn't stop printing money, so the government keep going.
So what happened after 18 months?
She had, like, from a house, she had the equivalent for $4.
So her money had lost, the hyperinflation,
pretty much she lost the house.
Right. As not opposed to what had been a hard asset, a real asset, like a house, which would have retained its value.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's what happened to her. She never, even today, she's like 54, you know, 54, 55. If you talk to her, she will like, oh, you stupid, you're putting your money in a bank. Government can take any time. She will call you stupid by saving money on the bank. She calls me stupid.
Okay, so you came to the U.S. in 2008 and were sort of surprised. It was a revelation to live in a country where there is no hyperinflation, right?
Well, from my perspective, there's no inflation here. That didn't amaze me on the first year, you know, in the first year when I come here, I realize, oh, okay, cool, everything has a price, okay, everything's, I didn't even notice. After the second year, when my landlord didn't raise my rent, in Brazil, every year your landlord is going to raise your rent at least 10%. So you know that you're going to have to renegotiate your rent prices every single year. It's also the salary. Like here, after 1 year, my salary didn't change, but my rent also didn't change. It was the same. And all the groceries, everything I was buying was like pretty much the same price, right? Of course, there were some fluctuations, but it came back. The gasoline went really high because of the oil, but then it crashed. And it was like, okay, there's actually after four or five years, inflation was not even a concern for me.
And you know, I mean, this relates to this issue of, I was just reading an article this morning, it wasn't quite Bitcoin is dead, but it was Bitcoin hasn't, you know, it created in 2008, really got going 2009, it's failed. It hasn't made an impact. And in the US, it is not, the average person doesn't use Bitcoin. But in Latin America, actually, and that's sort of what your expertise is with Brazil and Venezuela, and then there's also a really interesting Bitcoin phenomenon going on in Argentina, which is a similar story. Tell me about that. Compare sort of the Latin American Bitcoin potential to what we have here in the U.S.
Well, first, if you are a regular American, you don't need Bitcoin, right? Dollars work very well. And you can safely store your money in the bank. You have governments going to guarantee you up to $250,000. And the money is stable. I mean, I don't see a reason for why an American would use Bitcoin. But when you look in other countries, there's like, I don't see a reason why you're not going to use Bitcoin. Because it's just going to save you money. It's going to save you money when importing goods. It's going to save you money by protecting you against inflation. Even though Bitcoin is volatile, it's always going up. I mean, there's only when you, I think you mentioned that Bitcoin went to $1,000. It went to $1,000 in a period of, 2 weeks? And then it crashed, right? But if you ignore this period, it's always up. It's like...
So it's an easy sell for Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin, another difficulty in Bitcoin is it's hard to explain Bitcoin to people, right?
You don't have to. You just.
But in Latin America, what is it like signing people up?
Well, you don't have to explain. They see the gangs. They see, I mean, the Venezuelan is like, I don't even have to invest in acquiring customers. They it's like going like people talking to people. Hey, look, you know, like I bought this Bitcoin. It went up in price or... doesn't have inflation. That's it. The government can't print more Bitcoins. That's like, okay, cool. This must be good. This must be the future. It's like, oh, I can have that. It's like, it solves a problem. It solves a real problem in Latin America. And not only Latin America, I mean, most of the world, it solves a real problem. And that's the kind of stuff. Like when you look at a PayPal founders, when you read the PayPal, one of the founders wrote a book and he said, one of the missions of PayPal was to deliver the stability that US dollar had elsewhere, out the world. He was like, oh, I'm gonna give these assets, I can't even think about giving access to US dollars to those people in those countries where they are like screwed by the government every 4 or 5 years. But of course, he couldn't do it because of the regulations, right? In those countries, there's like, but Bitcoin is kind of being able to do it. What the original vision of the PayPal founder had is actually what Bitcoin is doing, because there's no way to stop it. So that's what I would say the reason why Bitcoin is successful. I mean, I don't see how it failed. You know, like I use it there. I see everyday users, and when people start using it in Latin America, I never seen a person complaining, hey, this shit doesn't work, or you know, anything. They just keep using it. It's like it solves their problem.
Okay. Before we wrap, I want to talk about you came to the US, you were not a libertarian. You're kind of, I follow you on Facebook, you're pretty outspoken in your views. Where did your libertarianism come from?
Well, I never thought about politics before. I used to like people, I mean, I was like a regular guy who just, you know, like only focused on my personal problems and never really focused on politicians. And when I came to this country, my English was not that good too. Even today is not that good, but I can follow a movie. And I start watching videos about Milton Friedman from 1978. And all this stuff Milton Friedman was saying, like, oh, Jesus, this is so actual. This is so true. Like, why people are not doing whatever he's saying?
This must be the famous PBS series, Free to Choose.
Yeah, Free to Choose. When I saw that, like, oh, man, this is like... And then I got very interested in economics. My wife, she went to Colombia to study economics there. So, and what she was doing, she was like, every single day, I said, okay, I'm going to pay your tuition, but you're going to have to teach me everything you learned there. So every single day, she came back from the school, we go for a walk, and she was teaching me everything she was teaching. I was just fascinated, like, hey, so government, so inflation is not because of people raising the prices. That's what I was fed when it was like, oh, those merchants are bad people. They raise their prices because they're greedy, right? And when I learned that inflation was actually caused by bad monetary policy, when government actually brings a little bit more money than the economy grows, and that generates inflation, I'm like, okay, this is
as opposed to greed, right? You had the assumption, the acting assumption was that the reason why things always cost more is because the sellers, the greedy capitalists, are always demanding more.
That was what I was taught in the school when I was a kid. That was the government was saying on TV all the time in Brazil. But of course, in America, they don't even discuss that because there is no such thing as inflation here in short term, right? It's not a problem. People, if you ask anyone in the street, what is your biggest concerns in your life today? People are going to mention a lot of different stuff. In Brazil, they will say, inflation, violence, inflation, you know, like inflation is going to be on the top five. That's the kind of thing. And not only in Brazil, I think everywhere. When I was like, okay, this is like so simple to solve. It's like Milton Friedman advocated by a Federal Reserve being replaced by a computer who prints money at the rate of 2% a year, or fixed rate where everybody can adjust. It's like, wait, why everybody doesn't do that? You know, like, and that started me like learning about it. And then Ron Paul was running, and I was like, Ron Paul was like anti-war speech, and I say, yeah, I agree with this guy. He's like, I just start following. Like, I wouldn't say I am outspoken libertarian. I just, you know, like, it's just like how the world should be, right?
It's like, well, you're not, and I'm, you know, I did a story a few months ago about the libertarian movement in Brazil, which helped to impeach President Dilma Rousseff. And you're, I know you're a little bit kind of pessimistic about change through politics, right? You're talk about that. What is the, and yet you're extremely optimistic overall.
Well, I don't think a libertarian, I mean, there's the book of David Friedman, where it's like on the last chapter, he talks.
This is called The Machinery of Freedom.
The last chapter, he explains about the Libertarian Party and why it's important. So on his book, he mentions that once the political power gets enough big, professional politicians are going to take over, but it's still going to be divided because the party, it runs on the ideology and is going to spread the libertarian ideology. So I'm optimistic about it because the Libertarian Party in Brazil, or the Movimento Brasil Livre, which is the free Brazil movement, is actually spreading ideas about freedom. But I'm pessimistic in a point where I know the professional politicians are just going to take over. When this movement grows bigger, professional politicians are going to take over. But that's the part I'm pessimistic about, because I think...
Well, but I would kind of classify you as an... tell me about your optimism.
My optimism is like on technology. I think when you look at technology, like... just look at 5 years ago, would it be unthinkable for you to get into a stranger's car to ride you from point A to point B. And today, people don't even use taxis anymore. They just use Uber. And Uber is not regulated or controlled by the government. It's pretty much like a technology made by entrepreneurs that's solving a problem that the government was solving with medallions first. Because, look, you have to understand, the government... The reason the government exists is because they solve problems in the real life. And they solve by terrible ways, like by regulations, but they're like, at the end of the day, they're trying to solve problems in a free society, right? Like medallions was like, okay, so we're going to protect consumers or whatever, but we're using a very archaic and old-fashioned way of doing things that are very inefficient. That's what the government does. But at the moment that a technology appears that saves people, like, oh, you don't have to use this whole government control anymore. You can just use technology that will achieve the same results, which is like getting a reliable and a safe driver to drive you from point A to point B. The driver is not going to rip you off. They're not going to kill you. They're not going to shoot you. We have all the information. And like, okay, the problem is solved by the technology. And I think the technology itself is going to solve so much problems. Like, for example, 3D printing. 3D printing is going to solve a lot of distribution problems. And it might solve a lot of other problems that the government tries to solve. Bitcoin is going to solve a huge problem, which is like allowing people to transact their goods and services without having to like, oh, I give you half a cow and you give me half a sofa and we can trade. Because money at the end of the day is an exchange of value, and government solves that. Of course, it's inefficient, but government solves that.
And so Bitcoin, as you said, is that's the ultimate, almost the ultimate case of this.
Well, Bitcoin is going to allow people to transact with each other without a government safely. Why would you want a government to tax your transactions in 50% if you can do it for free? So people are driven by their self-interest. And because of that, people are just going to use whatever the best tool they have. And that's why I think technology is going to drive to a freer society. Oh,
and how does that, long term, what does that mean for Bitcoin in the United States? I mean, to use your framework, Bitcoin would happen first in Latin America because the governments of Latin America have done a worse job with their money and they're far more protectionist. Here, the government's solution to money works better. Ultimately, what do you think about Bitcoin in here?
The U.S. government solution for money works best in America only in America, because when you look at the other countries, the world used to be on a gold standard, and now we are on a dollar standard. And dollar is only printed and controlled by the Federal Reserve. So when you look at all the other countries in the world where they are adopting dollar standard, the moment those other countries don't need a dollar standard anymore, that's the moment that the US dollar is not going to be, I think, is not going to be that powerful anymore. And that's the point. I think United States is going to be the last one. Because today you can use your dollars to buy fish from Vietnam. By the way, I also have a broker in Vietnam. You can use your dollars to buy a fish from Vietnam. And the fish exporters in Vietnam, they prefer dollars than bitcoins. But we are offering those fish exporters in Venezuela, say, look,
you don't have Vietnam.
In Vietnam, you don't have to export your fish to receive in dollars, because dollars might be confiscated by Vietnamese government. Why don't you take Vietnamese dongs directly or bitcoins? Like, we are convincing the fish exporters in Vietnam to use Bitcoin to transact globally. And I mean, when they do with Bitcoin, they save money. And just by they're allowing them to save money on foreign exchange rate by using Bitcoin, is a bit like, oh, they, you know, if this thing goes and takes over Vietnam, for example, the Americans, they would have to buy Bitcoins in order to transact with the Vietnamese fish exporter. And I think this might happen everywhere in the whole world. I mean, it's just much more efficient to use Bitcoin than US dollar. That's what I think.
So you're bullish on Bitcoin for the world. Let me, just to wrap up, give me a sort of, where is this heading? I want to bring it back to Venezuela. Where is this heading? I mean, Venezuela, we're talking about a country, this is a humanitarian crisis, and it seems to get worse by the day. What is happening? What's happening? Going to happen with Sir Bitcoin, and what's going to happen with Bitcoin in Venezuela?
Oh, any prediction I can make about Venezuela is going to be wrong. So I feel bad because I'm profiting from a very terrible situation. But hopefully the country is going to, it's just going to collapse. I read collapse it, right? It's just, I think people are going to wake up there. Like, the people who are, I don't even know what to say. It's so there's so much stuff going on in Venezuela that I don't even know how to, if I
will
were,
Bitcoin use spread? Will it? And you know, it is also, this is largely still a middle class phenomenon. It's sort of the tech savvy, right? Yeah. Who are into Bitcoin, and it's making a huge difference in their lives. But the really desperately poor people, the people who are actually going, kids who have kids that are going to school hungry. They're not into Bitcoin yet, and Bitcoin has, one of the obstacles is that Bitcoin is sort of complicated, and you need computers to do Bitcoin. What will it kind of continue to permeate?
Yes, it will. And Bitcoin, it's difficult, yes, but it was much more difficult 2 years ago. It's getting easier and easier, and that's just the evolution of Bitcoin. It's just going to become more accessible, easier to use, easier to understand. And as more people use it, it's just going to be like in the hands of average people in Venezuela, hopefully. But it's very hard to predict, because the country is like every day it's a new day in Venezuela.
Okay, well, let's leave it there. Thank you, Rodrigo Souza, with Blink Trade, and that is the company that's operating the leading Bitcoin exchanges in Vietnam, Pakistan, Venezuela, Brazil, and the second largest in Chile. Sort of a very big force in the Bitcoin world and in all of these countries, particularly in Latin America. I'm Jim Epstein. Please subscribe to our podcast. Also, if you want to find out more about Bitcoin in Venezuela, you can read my article on the current issue of Reason magazine, which is called The Secret Dangerous World of Venezuelan Bitcoin Mining. Rodrigo, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.